Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Brakes? We can save you 15% on that. We have OE quality Duralast brake pads and rotors in stock, ready for pickup or delivery. We also have calipers, brake fluid, tools, and anything else you'll need to do the job right. When you get Duralast pads and rotors together, you'll save 15%. It's just part of what makes us America's number one brakes destination.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Hello there. Happy Halloween. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby. And I am your host, Liv. And yes, I am here on a Monday instead of a Tuesday. And you know why? Because Halloween. Today, I am here with a special conversation episode dedicated to all things, well, dead. This episode is coming into your feeds today instead of Tuesday's usual episode because Halloween. I needed more spooky in my life, and so did you. But you will still have the Cupid After Show episode on Wednesday and Friday's regular episode. But today I called in on friend of the podcast, fan favorite, the one who knows about all the things dead, Dr. Ellie Mackin-Roberts. In the first ever 3-time repeat guest, Ellie is back on my show to talk underworld gods and so much more. I called on this favor at the last minute when I realized that most of the sourcing I was using for this month's episodes were Ellie's own books, and I just needed to talk about the underworld more. And so, I mean, gods, who better to ask? And Ellie came through. Now, we had a truly amazing time, and sometimes what that means is that topics jump around a bit. Like, listening back, I'm realizing I kept getting excited by tiny little comments Ellie would make and then having her explain those bits and pieces and totally knock her off her original point. But you know what? It's all too interesting, and I have ADHD, so here we are. We talked about everyone's favorite psychopomp, Hermes, about the Renways, Melinoe, and Persephone herself. We talk about Hades and the cult of worship that existed around him. We talk about oracles of the dead. Yeah, you heard me right. Just you wait. Fuck, I learned so much, and I had so much fun. So, no more of my thrilled ramblings. Let's get right into the conversation, shall we? Halloween special. Communing with the ancient dead. The Underworld with Dr. Ellie Mackin-Roberts.
Thank you. the Underworld. I'm really excited about this. And obviously I had to talk to you about it. So did you do your whole PhD on Underworld Gods? Is like that kind of where you got into it? Or like, what's the background on why you know so much about Underworld Gods?
Well, yes, I did my PhD on Underworld Gods. It was Underworld Gods in Greek, ancient Greek cult and literature. And then that turned into the book in which I took a lot of the like big literature sections out. But I actually got interested in it because of Hermes, who is my favorite underworld god. Definitely. Because I did my master's thesis. So in Australia, master's is are slightly different than they are here in the UK. And I know that in America, you know, often people don't really even do a terminal master's. But I did a two-year research master's where I had to write a 50,000-word thesis. And I wrote it on Aeschylus's Eumenides and the sort of advancing this idea that Orestes' travels in the Eumenides is basically like a coming of age rite of passage, because he doesn't kind of undergo these, you know, big rites of passage that require his father, because his father is obviously not there. And then, and in part of it, I kind of advanced this idea that Hermes is the most important character in the Eumenides. And it's an idea that I 100% stand by today. And always will. And I think it's really interesting as a concept because Hermes is not a character in the play. He doesn't appear. He has no lines. Some scholars think that he might appear on stage relatively early on with Apollo in a section in which Apollo invokes him and says, essentially, Hermes, take Orestes to Athens. And they go, we later learn at the towards the end of the play when they're in Athens, we learn that they went by sea. You would normally not go from Delphi to Athens by sea. No. You would go over land. But so they go by sea. And so this kind of got me on this like path of thinking about sea journeys and the role of guides, divine guides, and this sort of thing, and kind of came to a conclusion that this is a death and rebirth. The reason that he travels via sea with Hermes is because he undergoes this death and rebirth rite of passage, because he kind of in that section he goes from polluted to unpolluted, from youth to man, from exile to king. So he's kind of undergoing this very like rapid fire, huge levels of transformation. And so that's kind of what got me interested in the underworld. And then obviously the original conception of the PhD thesis was completely different to how it turned out, and certainly very different to how the book turned out. And I was far more interested in the beginning in looking at minor characters, the Erinyes, you know, the nameless gods. I never was like particularly interested in the very later, you know, chthonic divinities, like Melanoe. And as I sort of came to learn, you know, and as you have kind of alluded to at various points in other episodes as well, Hecate being, you know, in my period, actually not really an underworld god at all. And then obviously, you know, you have to start thinking about the way that these gods manifest both in the mythology. There's not a lot of underworld related mythology, and also the way that they manifest in cult, and there's not a lot of underworld related cult as well. And I certainly don't think I necessarily do myself any favors in that respect by not reading the Eleusinian Mysteries in particular as an eschatological cult, which I don't think it is. And I think I have already talked on this podcast about my feelings on that in another episode. So yeah, that's sort of I assumed I did when I was talking about Persephone, but maybe I didn't.
I don't know. My brain is mush. I want to hear it again if I have.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, all religious practice in ancient Greece is about forming relationships with the gods, right? And I know that some scholars see this as like a one for one. I'm going to give you this thing, you give me this thing. I'll give you this, you give me this. But I don't see it that way. I don't think that makes any sense for the way that people actually practice faith. It is, to my mind, and the evidence I think suggests this, far more about building ongoing reciprocal relationships in the same way that you like build friendships or build relationships with like your teachers, or you know, even build relationships with you know, other authority figures in your life, where there is a two-way exchange. But that doesn't have to be completely equal all the time, that there can be times when one person is giving much more than the other person, knowing that, you know, as my mother would say, everything works out in the wash. And so that's kind of what I think we have to be working with at the base. And so to say that the Eleusinian Mysteries are like, we are going to do this thing, we're going to participate in this massive ritual process in which realistically you like normal people are only doing two festivals, the first Lesser Mysteries and the first of the Eleusinian Mysteries. A smaller number of people are doing three, where they then go back to the Eleusinian Mysteries probably several years later and act as the like elder initiates in the role of like the Musti. And so this is like to say we're doing this these two things and then we're going to get this amazing afterlife, to me makes no sense. I think it makes far more sense if you read it in the context of a person building a lifelong relationship with Demeter and Persephone, particularly by, you know, also undergoing annual festivals like going to the Thesmophoria, or, you know, other Demetrian fertility festivals. And this is just one part of that relationship building. And maybe one of the things that you get from Persephone when you build a strong, long-lasting relationship with her is preferential treatment in the underworld. But actually, we don't really have any evidence of people being able to like get preferential treatment in the underworld from the Eleusinian Mysteries. You know, it's not like we have the evidence that we have for like the Orphic Mysteries with the gold tablets, where we have, you know, like the instructions and drink from, you know, don't drink from the Fountain of Lethe, drink from the Fountain of Mnemosyne, forgetfulness and memory. You know, and those sorts of things. And we just don't kind of have that same level of information. And yeah, that could be, you know, because people don't talk about the mysteries because they're not allowed to. But like I don't know. I just don't feel like it makes sense in the broader conception of building faith relationships with the divine, that you do this one thing and then you get like, it's not like buying VIP tickets.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I've never had the I guess time really to, and all right, chosen to devote the time to really getting into the Eleusinian Mysteries. So like much of what I know is just like whatever I've kind of gleaned, you know, over time, which so often like that's the idea that's presented, that like that's its explicit reason. But it does, like, your argument makes perfect sense as well, that like, yeah, like a one-off thing is not really something that happened often in like that kind of world. And so yeah, that's so interesting. I have like my own obsession with the Samothracian mystery cult, and so every time I think about any yeah. mystery cult, I come back to that too, is like, because it's, I mean, even more mysterious. But I just think, because that one too is kind of like a one-off, where we think it's like you got safety upon the seas, right? And it's like, well, yeah, was that also a practical thing? I mean, in that case, we don't even know what gods they worshipped, and there's like, anyway, I could go on with that. I was recently like talking about my trip to Samothrace, was like all deep in my head.
It's such an incredible place.
Oh my God, it's the greatest place I've ever been in my life. I don't know how to like properly express how I felt on that island. Like, yeah, no, it's like game changing. But it's not about death. It's fine.
Well, so, you say that, but
okay.
don't get excited. This is going to be such tangential. You say it's not about death, but of course we have this idea that like people who are actively on the seas are so in danger that they are in the precipice between, you know, this like how many people are in the underworld and how many people are dead and how many people are alive. Well, like, where do you count the sailors?
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember who that's from, but it is ancient. It is this like ancient idea.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I mean, and yeah, that's something I've thought about from past episodes recently as well, of like the level of danger that the sea would have been back then. I mean, it's dangerous now, and then thinking about it back then and the mysterious level of it, like the idea of like what is lurking beneath that they have no idea. That is fascinating in itself. The Eleusinian mysteries generally are utterly fascinating, and I would love to hear more about them, or I should say, but like I'm so fascinated by the, I guess, lack of information about the underworld and the gods down there. But like clearly they were very important. I'm interested in what the modern world has done with them too. Like when it comes to Malinui, I got multiple people suggesting I cover her on the podcast, like in an episode. And then I go looking for ancient sources, and it's like one Orphic hymn. And I'm like, what? Where are you all getting her name that you want me to cover this woman who is in a singular Orphic hymn? Like,
yeah, that's wild. Probably to me. Like one of the latest ones, like third century CE.
Yeah, and it's like, it's just a couple statements about her.
It's like, do you know what I genuinely reckon it is? I think people, like, in the, you know, Persephone and Hades retelling romance genre, you know, of work that's kind of come up in the last, you know, couple of years. I think people really want to, and I kind of glean this idea from, like, you know, things I read on, like, Reddit and TikTok, not read on TikTok, but you know what I mean, and see on TikTok and Twitter. People want to take this idea of the romance of Hades and Persephone to, like, a happy ever after. And if they have children, then that is a happy ever after. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, I think people have kind of very much, like, latched onto Zagreus, Dionysus Zagreus, for similar reasons. And as you kind of know from having covered the Orphic tradition, like, quite recently, it's not as simple as, you know, anything. Yeah. Like, that's not a simple tradition in any way. But it kind of, like, it, I think it's a lot more comforting to think that, you know, even underworld divinities can have a happily ever after. And maybe they do, but they certainly don't have children. And that is the point. And I think it probably also has to do with, like, Persephone being a spring goddess. Like, she's not, I think.
You don't think she's the goddess of spring either in that way?
No.
Oh, I love this.
No, why? I don't.
Okay.
And I don't think she's a goddess of fertility either.
Ooh.
Because she, like, this is a very, like, a crude metaphorical way of putting it, but, like, she's the seed which is buried, not the plant that grows.
Mm.
Like, the seasons happen because of Demeter. Persephone has mm-hmm. nothing to do with it. She was tangentially, well, not tangentially, she was kidnapped. And,
yeah.
you know, her mother as a fertility divinity is the one who brings forth growth and stunts growth. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, Persephone doesn't do that. And in our very earliest sources, you know, she is just a goddess of the underworld and a ruler of the underworld in a way that, like, kind of almost doesn't fit with the idea of her origin story of the relationship of Hades and Persephone. That's something that I struggle with a lot, because in Homer, in the Odyssey in particular, she is presented as the leader of the dead, or the mm-hmm. leader of the underworld. She is like the custodian of the dead. She is the one who kind of runs everything. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it's not even particularly clear grammatically or syntactically if Hades is being referred to as a god or just as the place.
Mm.
Like, there are places where he is, like, very concretely characterized, very notably in the Iliad when Poseidon shakes the earth and Hades fears that the earth will break away and his realm will be exposed. And so, like, he is there, but it's almost like he's this kind of absentee lord, and Persephone is the one who kind of does the work.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I read in, I'm going to forget where, but in my research for the episode I released this week, is that also in Homer, Persephone is not named as Demeter's daughter. She's
no.
like an underworld deity. And yeah, and that isn't explicit, which that is really interesting to me. And so, yeah, the opening that question of, like, was there a time when the Persephone of the underworld and Kore of Demeter's daughter were different people? And, like,
yeah. I mean, I think that I tend to, like, read them as the same person or same divinity, partly mm-hmm. because I think archaic and classical Greeks read them as the same person. Mm. And so in some ways it's almost a moot point.
Right.
You know, in terms of my research into religion and cult, whether they were originally separate divinities or not. But then also she's called Persephone in the Homeric hymn. And mm-hmm. so if they were originally separate, then at least by the 6th century,
mm-hmm.
You know, perhaps 7th century even, they're amalgamated enough mm-hmm. That, you know, the story makes sense to be Persephone rather than to be Kore.
Right.
But then, you know, we also get into, like, the weirdness with the Eleusinian mysteries where we have Kore and Pluton and this other couple, Thea and Theos, the god and the goddess, or Theos and Thea, the god and the goddess, who are Hades and Persephone. And they appear together in iconographic representations mm-hmm. of Eleusis. We get both couples at the same time. And so that's also really interesting mm. about whether there's, you know, a delineation of roles and responsibilities that the mystery fertility, wealth gods. Not fertility, but wealth. Wealth and wealth creation kind of gods. And the gods of the dead, the underworld, become separated out in some way. But again, you know, like we don't know enough about the mysteries themselves, any of them, but in this case, the Eleusinian mysteries. We just don't know enough about like what happened to really understand that, whether that is a deliberate delineation between those two aspects, or indeed if we have read the whole thing incorrectly and Thea and Theos are not Hades and Persephone.
And they're like other gods.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I had no idea any of that. And so I don't even know. Now I'm just taking it all in, not even forming a question out of it, but that is fascinating. So they're just like two couples that we think in theory are both Hades and Persephone, but also they are two different Hades and Persephone. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, does it have anything to do with like, I mean, I'm thinking this through as I say it, but like the before abduction to post-abduction, like I know they wouldn't have been a couple pre-abduction, obviously, but like I'm just thinking of like a above ground versus underworld or something.
Like, well, I have wondered, not necessarily that it's like a pre and post, but whether it actually is representative of that change of season where, you know, the underworld couple come up and transform into, you know, the above ground couple. Because Pluton still is a very underworld aspect, aspected divinity. Like, you know, he's wealth, he's Hades as wealth because of the wealth that is kept in the ground. And, you know, so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't have the answers. No, I wish I had the answers.
I mean, story of like everything I ever think about when it comes to the ancient world.
Indeed. And that's kingdom what we do, isn't machine. It?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's the wondering and the like theorizing, and it's why like conversations have become one of my favorite things to do, because even just talking it out loud to somebody else, like so often you can like not necessarily come up with like new thoughts, but it's more like just understand things in a totally different way, let alone the like the amount that I learned from talking to people, but also just like the favorite thing of mine that came out of something like that was so explicit in my head was like not ever really thinking about why like the children of Helios are all like Eastern gods, like in Colchis, and then being like just chatting with someone one day and being like, wait, it's just because the sun is. And I just like lost it. I was like, oh my God.
I love that so much.
But it's especially with my role in this is like, I am so in the stories that often it does take like talking to somebody else to like pull out the reality side of it, because in my I also, you know, like have an English degree alongside my classics degree, and so I always kind of come at it more of like as a text that I'm reading versus thinking about it in the real world, which is something I try to do because it makes it so much more interesting. But yeah, like I think that's like such a result of it, is like it's why I also now bring up like absolutely constantly to my listeners like the consideration of like why we have the stories that we do, why pieces are missing, like why there are so many question marks, and it's like why we can't understand all of it, and that makes it better, I think, but also infuriating.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. Okay. I'm just like thinking about a question that I always ask my first years is some variation of like, what is the only corpus of texts that we have from the ancient world? The answer is epigraphy. Like the inscriptions.
Right.
That's the only thing that we have that's genuine ancient words.
Right.
Because everything else is mediated through like, you know, medieval and later scribes and the process of choice and all these sorts of things. And it's one of the things that I think is really both super fascinating and very bothersome about studying the underworld, or having studied the underworld, because like this constant question of how much more stuff actually was there that somebody decided not to save because it was heretical or whatever. Mm-hmm. And how much would I like to go back and just be in those like rooms of scribes and just be like,
no,
keep this one, please. Why are you keeping all this Menander? Nobody wants to read that.
I've never read a single word of Menander.
Oh, I must have told you this before, but I had to translate the Perichromene in my final year for Greek and it ruined me.
Now I think about it too. I think you're the only one who's ever even brought up Menander on my show. Probably for that was telling me that. But I do think it says a lot about him. Like, I feel like the only thing I know is just based on the fact that there's that statue of him in on the Acropolis. And like, otherwise I've got nothing. I'm just like, cool. Okay. He's the guy from the Acropolis. Yeah. Well, in the underworld, I've never thought about it in that way too. Like, I think constantly about the decisions that were made that led to what we have now and what we are missing. And, you know, because of how I go about things, half the time I'm thinking about like, okay, what stories do we have or do we not have because a woman wrote them or because they featured women in a different way that somebody didn't like, or all these different things, right? Revolving around women.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, add to that the idea of it must be such a specific question mark of the underworld because of Christianity in a way that I'd never thought of. Like, I just generally the paganism alone, I think, is why we don't have a lot, because Christianity came about doing that. But specifically, yeah, the underworld would have such deeper implications there.
Yeah. The evidence that we have is not significant in any way. Like, there's some evidence of cult activity. Like, it's not, it's, I think, very disingenuous to say that Hades has no cult. Mm. But there's certainly not a lot, and it is deeply bizarre, the bits that there are. Some bits are deeply bizarre. Some bits are very normal, like, you know, a statue of Pluton in another god's temple, which, you know, Pausanias tells us quite a bit mm-hmm. about.
I was just reading up on that because I've been now like really keen on Pausanias because it's fascinating, but specifically reading up on some of the Hades stuff was quite interesting for that. Yeah. Just like little statues of him kind of everywhere.
Yeah. And just in like, and you know, that's like quite normal. Pausanias talks about this sort of everywhere, like of having statues of all different types of gods in mm-hmm. all different other types of temples. And there are certainly fewer of Pluton, and he normally calls Hades Pluton. By the time he's writing in the second century, you know, like the two have completely amalgamated into one another. And that's something which is already like very clearly happening early on, you know, even in the archaic period as well, and into the classical period. But then there are other bits that he kind of talks about that we have other kind of corroborating evidence for that are just deeply weird, like the cult of Demeter Chthonia at Hermione in the Argolid. And this is a super fascinating and very, very weird sort of cult in which this is all from Pausanias and other kind of bits of later sources. In the sanctuary grounds of Demeter Chthonia is these kind of three, what Pausanias calls places. One of, I'm going to forget what they're of now. Anyway, one of them is of Clymenos. And this is kind of seen as a euphemism, a euphemistic name for Hades.
Hmm.
And Clymenos is Demeter Chthonia's brother and her daughter's husband. So, I mean, it fits.
Yeah.
But in the the festival of Demeter Chthonia is this like weird, weird sacrifice. They have this huge procession in which young children are involved wearing like specific flower crowns that are inscribed with letters and letters like of mourning, like of lament, wailing. And then the sacrifice takes place inside a closed temple, which is already really weird. Like sacrifice always takes place outside. They sacrifice cows or bulls
inside a temple.
Inside the temple, wow. Four of them.
Wow.
And there are four elderly women who are inside the temple with sickles, not like knives or anything, with sickles specifically. And the first cow is like pushed into the temple, essentially, and they slaughter the cow. And then however that is done, how Pausanias talks about whichever side that cow goes to. So kind of read it like if the cow is killed from like the left and falls that way, left, then all the other cows have to be killed in the same way. And then they bring the bodies out to butcher, etc. But yeah, it's just this kind of really weird. First, women are not often sacrificers. Elderly women, even less. And to have such a bizarre sacrificial implement like a sickle. And the vocabulary that Pausanias uses to describe this is also really interesting. It's very, very violent. He talks about it using vocabulary that he only uses a couple of other times in the entirety of his work and only for murders. So he, you know, it's this very, very violent, subversive sacrifice for an underworld god, or here an underworld goddess, actually, who is not one of our regular, you know, underworld divinities that we might think of, Hades, Persephone, you know, but Demeter in this very kind of earthy, earthbound, you know, chthonic in the actual sense of in the ground. And you know, I really like the link, the conceptual link between that and that little section line in the Homeric hymn where they talk about burying seeds, and you know, with the kind of imagery of burying bodies, that, you know, it's almost as if they need to die and be buried in order to be reborn as new plants.
That's so cool. So, I mean, I'm just trying to think of like the practicalities too. Like that alone is interesting. Like the sacrificing indoors,
because in the dark. Yeah, it would very likely be dark.
Yeah. Oh, it's so creepy. I love it. And then the sickle too. Like, is that like, I mean, it sounds like it's connecting with Demeter because it would be like a harvest kind of situation. But I was wondering too, like whether it can connect back to Kronos in some way. It feels like violent, like his sickle experience.
Yeah, I never thought about that, to be honest. But that's, I mean, a decent enough connection to make. I mean, I think the thing about sickles is that, you know, they're common, not household, but, you know, property kind of things that you have. Like, you know, they're things that you have around the farm.
Yeah, they're practical.
Yeah. And I guess that also sort of raises questions about, like, the role of objects in religious practice. You know, I think that because of the way that modern religions and even modern pagan religions treat ritual objects. Sometimes I think we kind of forget that, like, objects don't have to be, objects can be made sacred temporarily quite easily. You know, most religions have a way to do this, and the Greeks certainly, like, had a sense of making something sacred, of purifying it through, like, sacred water or whatever. And, you know, sacred water for archaic and classical Greeks was not anything special.
Mm-hmm.
It was water from a running source. So, you know, like, it wasn't something that kind of, you know, got blessed by the moon and we had to, like, dance around three times chanting, and it wasn't something which, you know, had to be put into, like, a special container and blessed by a priest. You know, it wasn't, and it just had to be from a running source. And, you know, in a lot of ways that comes back to the idea that Greek religion is, like, a nature religion but taken to the extreme. But so, you know, it makes sense that, like, you have objects around that can kill cows. So use them.
Yeah, like, it works.
Yeah. And I kind of, like, obviously there's no evidence for this, but when we find, you know, instances of those sorts of things, I do wonder, and particularly in this case, whether it's not just that at some point someone made the connection. Demeter is a goddess of fertility. We have the sharp tool that, you know, we use in the harvest, which is under her domain. It makes sense for us to use this at, and, you know, it doesn't have to be any more complicated than that. Like, we've got this thing, it'll do the job. It's already associated with the divinity that we're talking about. Let's just use it.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today?
I got to change the oil in my car.
Right now, get 5 quarts of Pennzoil Platinum Full Synthetic with an STP Extended Life Oil Filter for only $36.99.
What do I do with my old oil?
We can recycle your used oil for free.
And do you have oil for my old work truck?
You can find the right high mileage oil to help it go farther right here at AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
That's so interesting generally, but it led me to remember this other passage I read in the, it was on theoi.com section on the Hades cult. And I'm going to forget whether it was Pausanias or it might have been a moment where it was, I know there was a Strabo one that I found as well, but regardless, it was either one of the two. And it was talking about a temple to Hades in Elis.
The cult at Elis. Yeah.
Yes. So I desperately want to hear more about that because I read that and was like, holy shit, like this is a wild little passage to be reading.
Well, I mean, like, I can't really tell you more than is in the passage.
Fair.
It's a temple which is opened once a year and only the priest is allowed to enter because going in to the Temple of Hades is going in to Hades itself, and you cannot like continually die. The thing that I find the most interesting about that passage, it is in Pausanias, and it's only time that Pausanias calls Hades Hades and not Pluton. And I think that's really interesting because I think perhaps it indicates that this is a very old cult, that it is very stable in its practice, and which kind of makes sense, right? When you only have one person really who is doing the majority of the participation and handing that on to the next person, there's not, even over large amounts of time, there's not really a lot of space for innovation. And even where there is innovation, it's not necessarily something which is considered change, because you're talking about one person kind of handing on to the next person, to the next person, to the next person. And I don't think that Pausanias says this, but in my mind, it's a hereditary cult. I think that that like maybe is like my own headcanon for it, but it makes sense to me. But yeah, I think it kind of shows that this is like a very old sacred practice. And of course, there is the link too with the Necumantian at Elis on the river Acheron, obvious links to the Acheron of the underworld.
I didn't know there was a real Acheron.
There is. It is in Elis.
Oh my gosh.
And in a little town called Thesprontia, I want to say. And there's a temple complex there, or a building complex there, that kind of seems to indicate a movement around in which, you know, it has been theorized. And I have a couple of times given papers about this using a guided meditation at the start. And actually, it's the passage that I use for this is the passage that's right at the front of my Underworld Gods book about the necromantic experience. You go in, you are given like into a very low light situation, perhaps even dark, for several days. The only other person that you come in contact with is the priest, who brings you food and drink. You can hear from inside the building complex, you can hear the running water. You're given foods that have mild toxicity, perhaps that might facilitate hallucination. At some point, the priest decides that you're ready to go on to the next step, brings you inside a lamb. I was about to say a tiny sheep, and I remembered there's a real word for that, lamb. You take the lamb in, you dig a pit, you sacrifice the lamb, drain the blood into the pit, which I hope is kind of recalling.
Did you see my face?
Odyssean sort of sacrificial
yes
lamb blood pit
dead. Immediately I was like, Odysseus does this.
Yeah. And various sort of other things, perhaps honey. And then you burn incense or something else. It seems unlikely that you would butcher and burn the lamb, but there is an idea of something that creates smoke, which obviously when you're in an enclosed space is very overwhelming. At some point around this time, you are either given or you pick up some stones of some kind. As you keep walking around, there's a point in which you have to kind of throw the stones as you, I assume, obviously we've got no evidence for this, but like pray and do various kind of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the main chamber of the building complex, in which you present your question to the dead. Whoever it is that you have tried to call up. Now, this is all obviously like a reconstruction based on like the archaeological evidence of things being found in places and like burning on the buildings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really interesting about this is there's the same kind of pulley, like large crane pulley structure behind the almost a false wall as you would have behind the stage at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one suggestion has been that perhaps the priest like facilitates your oracular experience with the dead by like sending ghosts, wooden ghosts, down for you to talk to.
Holy shit.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Just that's an enormous holy shit moment for me. So was this for one, I feel like this is a thing that is not well enough known. And I think that everyone should be talking about this all the time. but also, like, do we know anything about who went to do this and why, or no, just nothing?
No. Like, I mean, we can make some guesses about who went and why. You know, why do you go and why do you go to any oracle? You know, because you want answers to something. But why specifically might you go to an oracle in which you are talking to the dead, not underworld gods, not divinities, but specifically to the dead? You know, you might go because you deeply, deeply miss somebody and you want to speak with them. You might go because, you know, someone has left their entire fortune in a locked box and you can't find the key.
Yeah.
And everything sort of in between.
Yeah.
You know. And in the same way that, like, I think probably grief plays a massive role in this kind of cult, in the same way that, like, clairvoyance and mediums, those sorts of things, you know, have huge business from people experiencing grief. I kind of don't really want to, like, necessarily like diminish it down to that, because I think that for a lot of those people, even though like it's probably not a real thing, that probably still plays a massive role in, you know, their grieving process. And I think probably it was, you know, a very similar thing was happening here. But also you have to be able to afford it. You have to be able to afford to travel to a place which is like not easily accessible and take several days off from your life and an unspecified amount of time off, right? And to pay the priest and for everything that you're kind of doing. So, you know, I tend to kind of think it's probably like majority relatively wealthy people who are undergoing grief.
Yeah. Yeah. fucking fascinating, honestly. Like, I don't know. I would like to learn more. No, I just am thinking about, like, every time I learn something new and my brain goes and explodes as if it's something that hasn't happened before. And it's like every week that I talk to people. But, like, I don't know. That's so fascinating to me. Was there more than one of these that we know of, or just this one?
So there were more than one. There are at least four.
Oh, wow.
The one in Ellis is the one that we know the most about.
Mm-hmm.
There was one in Asia Minor somewhere.
Okay.
Maybe I want to say somewhere on like the coast of what is now Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And one, I think, in northern Greece, maybe even into Macedonia.
Mm.
I should know where they are, and that's just not like readily available in my brain.
That's fair. That's fair. I almost did some diving into these for an episode and then ended up with too much. And I was like, great. Now I have content for next year. But of course, I should have known it would come up here too. But that did lead me also to something I wanted to clarify from earlier. So what was the kind of practical, or like what were the differences between using Hades' name of Hades versus Pluton? Like, I know it's like the wealth aspect, but was there more to it than that? Like, in terms of what name you're choosing to use?
I don't know. I really struggle with this. I know a lot of people say that, like, the Greeks were afraid to use the name Hades.
Mm.
I don't think that's the case. There is so many instances of Hades being called Hades that it just is not feasible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually comes from Plato's Cratylus.
Hmm.
Anyway, it's this like quite, it's not a very well read dialogue of Plato's, and it's not well read because it's about etymology. And so it's very difficult to kind of have a good translation of it. And so you kind of have to like know the Greek or be willing to kind of do the work of figuring out. And in one part, he talks about particularly Persephone and the reason that she's called Feraphata or Persephata, which is a cultic name that we find for her, particularly in Attica. And it's because people are afraid to invoke her name, and just like with Hades. But, like, it's not... To begin with, we can't use Plato for, like, evidence of what real normal people actually thought, or the way that they understood the divine, or the way that they practiced religion. And particularly, I think, not with this dialogue, because it is this, like, very forced etymological conversation.
Hmm.
I think it's very common for gods to be given a lot of different names, you know, whether that's epithets that go with their name, or whether it is like alternative names, like with Persephone and Kore. And we don't kind of tend to have this conversation about like, why do the Greeks call Zeus Zeus, but also Dios?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do the Greeks call Persephone Persephone, but also Kore? I mean, I have thoughts on that. Do I? Don't know. I think it just is like, you know, maybe there's something to say about there being an original differentiation between Pluton and Plutos, who's a different god again, and Hades, and that they kind of become connected. In terms of like Pausanias, you know, I think it's just because by that stage, like that's kind of a more Roman name, even though, you know, it is a Greek name. But yeah, so that doesn't really answer your question in anything more than like a very like roundabout sort of like, I think there's a lot less to say about it than perhaps some people would like to say.
Fair enough. Well, it's always kind of stood out to me that, like, as much as all the gods have multiple names, and like, I mean, it seems to me that Hades and Persephone, like both of them, have more names than the other gods. Because when it comes to the other gods, it tends to be more epithets than names. Like, yeah, bazillion different epithets when it comes to them. But in terms of like actual different names they're called, it seems to me that those two have more, which, I mean, like, also kind of just makes sense if you're talking about underworld gods, in my head at least, just in terms of, yeah, they're because they're going to have more sides. They're going to be more like multifaceted than the other gods because they're dealing in death. Yeah.
I kind of almost think it's like the opposite, that they're less multifaceted. And so because they have fewer aspects, they do not need as much differentiation, and therefore it doesn't have to be name plus epithet, because it's difficult to remember that this epithet goes with this god when this god has a bazillion epithets and they might be different all over the place. But when you're talking about a god that has an underworld aspect and a mortal world aspect, or a death aspect and a ground aspect in the case of Hades, like an underground and an in the ground, I think is what I mean. That's much easier to remember than, you know, to remember that it's just two aspects of one divinity. I don't know. That's not a like very well conceived thought. It's just, that's how I've sort of always seen it.
Yeah. That's all interesting. It doesn't all have to be perfect thoughts. They're all fascinating because like an ancient world is so fascinating. So I'm trying to decide where I want to lead this. Maybe just some other underworld gods, because I think probably people would be screaming for that. I mean, I know we talked briefly about Milinui, who's like fascinating in how she's not all that interesting, at least to me. But there are so many others. Like, for one, I get Hecate perhaps is not an underworld god, but is certainly still someone to talk that's interesting to talk about. But then I'm also just thinking of like the people who are down there, or like the concepts that are in the underworld. So like, do you have thoughts on the physicality of the underworld? Like, people have asked me before, like, how do I picture it? How does it? And my brain doesn't picture things. Like, I don't imagine what things looked like. I just have the thoughts, or I don't even know. But yeah, do you have any thoughts on the physicality?
Yes, but also no, because similarly, I don't think in pictures. I have aphantasia, so I've got like black behind these eyes. I don't picture the underworld really at all. Yeah. Other underworld gods that are interesting. The Erinyes are incredibly interesting. These divinities of vengeance who kind of are three but also innumerable, who originally are avengers of often kin-based violence, familial violence. They are goddesses who are also intricately connected with oaths. Mythologically, they attend the birth of Hawkus, oath, the personification of oath. And, you know, that really kind of makes sense, because the Greek conceptualizations of oaths are like curses. You know, it's a potential self curse. If I break this oath, then I will be cursed by this. And The Erinyes are several times called curses. You are curses beneath the ground, Clytemnestra calls them in the Eumenides of Aeschylus. That's a really interesting picture of them. It's the only time that divinities like that are pictured on the stage in any of our extant tragedies. Of course, that doesn't mean that they weren't in other places.
The unknown.
But Menander, man, why did they have to keep so much Menander? Anyway, that's neither here nor there. In that, like, she's dead. She's a ghost. Mm-hmm. And she controls them. She, like, rules over them. And Aeschylus.
Oh. So, sorry, who's she in this case? What am
Clytemnestra.
Fuck.
The ghost of Clytemnestra.
I've been way too long.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
She like and kind of like admonishes them for sleeping, and that's why Orestes can escape. Because
oh my God.
They sleep. And you know, they're described as like these oozing, black, horrific sorts of creatures. And then are turned into the kindly ones at the end of that play. And the imagery of the way that they are integrated into Athens is very interesting in terms of metics and the metic participation, the participation of metic resident foreigner girls in the Pan-Athenaic procession. But Athena in that play says that they're going to be honoured by the Athenians, and we have all these little altars to nameless gods on the side of the Acropolis and various other places around Athens that have been kind of identified as altars to the Semnaithei, the kindly ones, who, again, euphemistic name, like we're not calling them Semnaithei, it means venerable goddesses. Eumenides means kindly ones. Mm-hmm. You know, when again, not calling them like the Erinyes, the Furies by their name. But they're still very interesting. I really like them.
I was going to ask about your thoughts on the kindly ones' names too. Like, do we think that was like a regular practice, like a thing to call them that instead of using the name of the Erinyes? Or is it more so in this play than it is like a practical?
Well, in cult, it seems that they are far more often called nameless rather than being like euphemistically named. Mm-hmm. But they certainly are named the Semnaithei in other places. They're not ever called the Eumenides in the Eumenides. They're called the venerable goddesses. And that kind of like, I think that makes much more sense, the Semnaithei, because you can be venerable and still terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, that is not euphemistic in the same way as being like, you're not terrible, you're really great, you're so much fun and awesome. Yeah, it's kind of still acknowledging the power that they have.
That reminds me of another Pausanias thing that I found, which is that there was like a temple or something to them in Athens, he mentions.
Oh yeah, he does, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he says that there was like statues of Hades, Gaia, and Hermes inside. Yeah, I just generally found that fascinating. Do we think that was like I mean, I guess if he saw it.
I mean, if he, well, yes, but it's not something that we have modern corroborating evidence for. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to kind of have, particularly kind of if we go back to this idea that if you have a temple to Hades, then you can't go into it. You know, that really stops people from, you know, being able to participate in cults when they are not allowed to participate in the cult. And so having worship to other divinities, having worship to Hades within the realm of other divinities and underworld divinities, it does make sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he also places it right by the Areopagus too. So it all checks out in such a fascinating way of thinking about their connection to the Areopagus and to people like accused of murder and things like that. And then also, having a temple or a sanctuary there to them, and then being able to put a statue of Hades in there, which means other people can go in. And the inclusion of Hermes and Gaia too was so interesting, and feels it's just so.
I mean, that makes sense though, doesn't it? Because in a very fundamental way, Hades is a god of the earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Hermes, as I have already mentioned,
is the cycle pump.
Yes. Hermes has several underworld related guises, not just as Psychopomp, guide of souls, but also as Hermes Chthonios.
Let's talk more about Hermes. What other
Hermes is amazing.
I know, that's why I want you talking more about him.
I mean, the most obvious underworld aspect of Hermes is that he is the Psychopomp, the guide of souls. The first literary example that we have of this is the false Nekia from book 24 of the Odyssey. It's very likely a later interpolation, but even so is, probably at least late 7th, early 6th century, in which he kind of, in this very Pied Piper-esque way, leads the souls of the dead as they are kind of whimpering into the underworld by the white rocks, and kind of takes them in that way. So one of the reasons that it's considered to be a later interpolation is because it doesn't really fit our understanding of how souls go to the underworld in the rest of Homer, which is in the Iliad. There's obviously lots of things to say about the fact that very unlikely that the Iliad and the Odyssey were written, composed by the same person, etc. But nevertheless, that, in the Iliad, when people die, their suke, their soul, flees their body, comes out their mouth or their nose or their wound, and leaves their body, and that's the moment that they die and then goes into the underworld. But here, Hermes is kind of collecting souls together and taking them away. Iconographically, we see various instances of Hermes either taking souls to Charon, to his boat, or just generally kind of leading them. It seems really that Hermes and Charon kind of work together as a psychopompic team in the in vase paintings. And particularly we find those on the white ground Lekythoi. So there's elongated oil jars. Which are often used as funerary offerings or even as kind of grave semer, grave markers, and are often used for oil offerings to the dead. And actually we found examples. This is kind of a slight non sequitur, but I think is very cool. We found examples of these where they've been sort of stopped up. So the long kind of almost cylindrical with this, vase with another sort of very long neck, thin long neck, and so evidence of the bottom of the neck being stopped up with wax and then oil being poured on the top of the wax and then being stopped up again. So there's only a little bit of wax of oil in the top, but if you took the lid off, you'd look in and it would look like it was full. Right. So maybe, ideas of if you spend all of the money that you have on the Lekythos and you can't afford to fill it with oil, then maybe you you know, just put a little bit at the top. But yeah, a lot of these have images of Hermes as Psychopompos. Mm-hmm. But then we also have, you know, Hermes is the sole messenger to Hades. He is the only divinity apart from Hades who can independently travel into and out of the underworld. And that includes Persephone. She does not travel into and out of the underworld on her own. Mm. And so that's a very special thing. And this is all kind of related to, you know, Hermes's ability as a boundary leader, a boundary crosser, a boundary leader. You know, he is the boundary stone, the Herm. He is a god who lives in the margins, and that includes in the margins between life and death as well. He, of course, retrieves Persephone from the underworld in the Homeric hymn, and then when she goes back and forth, it's always with Hecate. She doesn't kind of go on her own. Hermes is really fascinating. This is why, just to kind of come out of the ancient world a little bit, this is why I think the choice of Hermes as the narrator in Hades Town was so brilliant, because he just lives in this kind of liminal space. And of course, the whole of Hades Town is set in the kind of liminal space just before you move to the underworld.
Huh. So one thing that I know my listeners are going to be yelling, primarily because of their pretty broad love for Lore Olympus, is Thanatos. And I also know that, yes, and I read a section of your book on Thanatos and was like, this is fascinating, but I was talking too much about goddesses that I couldn't get into him. So this is perfect. So say anything, because I know that there's so much going on there in terms of him. Thanatos
so interesting. Mm-hmm. So Thanatos is death. His name comes from the word "I am dying," or "I die." You know, so he is like an embodiment of death, but he doesn't kill people. He just kind of, well, he does sort of kill people. That was disingenuous. But not maliciously. He's not like a violent death. Mm-hmm. He's not, you know, he's just
dying. The concept of dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the very first times that we meet him is in the Iliad, where he and brother Hypnos sleep, pick up the body of Zeus's son Sarpedon from the floor of the battle, the battlefield. and take him home to
Lycia,
that's right. To be buried properly. So they don't take him into the underworld. I think a lot of people do have this idea that they take him into the underworld. They don't. They take him home to be, they take his body home to be buried properly. This becomes really like well represented in art.
I can picture it.
And, you know, yeah, some very, very famous examples of this, including the eponymous Sarpedon vase. But this iconography of Thanatos and Hypnos taking a body away becomes much, much more ubiquitous. First, we find other real, presumably, soldiers who perhaps have been killed in battle being represented, maybe by their families, on these white ground lekathoi. And then even when we get like into the, you know, later classical period, we even find women being represented as being taken away by Thanatos and Hypnos. Which I think is really lovely, that it becomes this like emblematic of this gentle movement of the body and therefore of the soul, like from one plane into the other.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other really, so Hesiod, he is the child of Nyx via parthenogenesis, so he has no father, and has, you know, that whole litany of siblings of similar, you know, Eris and all the others. Mm-hmm. And then the next really big literary appearance is in the Alcestis, mm-hmm. which we have already spoken mm-hmm. about at length.
And specifically that scene.
Yes.
Oh my God, Hermes or Heracles wrestling death.
Yes. And so, you know, that's also really interesting. Iconographically, he is usually a soldier in like a full panoply. So that's, you know, a helmet, armor, greaves, shield, spear, sword. He has winged sandals. Later, he is depicted as winged rather than just having winged sandals. And then, you know, various kind of ages, but often in that sort of youthful maturity. Does that make sense? Like mm-hmm. that moment where like men become, are no longer boys, but they're not kind of your elder statesman,
mm-hmm.
kind of vigorous youthfulness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love that he's depicted with his brother sleep too, like, or, and just that the idea that they are siblings in that way is such a lovely connection where you can kind of see the imagining of death being just like a long sleep. Like they're really connecting those two concepts in a really lovely way.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things I think to remind people who, especially just people that are coming to Greek mythology from pop culture, it is just the way that like Christianity has influenced how we think about these things and the underworld and Hades and all of it, because we have these ideas of like death being something to be afraid of, the underworld being like hell, Hades being bad. Like he still always has to be the villain in so many different things when we're actually looking at the traditions and the mythology and the cult. Everything about ancient Greece suggests they weren't afraid of him.
Yeah.
He was just there because someone had to do it.
Yeah.
And I find so fascinating.
And that he was, you know, he's not this Grim Reaper-esque kind of figure, mm-hmm. right? He is represented as a normal, heroic, virtuous figure
mm-hmm.
in the kind of, you know, trappings of heroic virtuous figures.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise we wouldn't find him in the panoply. Like we wouldn't find him in the guise as a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
Because it that's not about the inherent violence of soldiering, right? It's about the valor. It's about mm-hmm. the heroicism. But it also is about the heroic nature with which people die. Normal people die in their normal circumstances and then are able to claim a level of interaction with this sympathetic, empathetic, heroic figure.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, so the other divinity of battlefield death is Ker. And she is the absolute opposite of Thanatos. She is, so often she is called the doom of death. And she's sort of this like doom-esque figure. And both Homer and Hesiod refer to her in the Shield of Achilles and the Shield of Heracles, respectively, and talk about her physically being frightening and monstrous, that her jaw gapes open to devour, that she wears this cloak that's stained red with blood, and that she kind of skulks around the sides of the battlefield and indiscriminately snatches men's lives away. So you don't have to be in like death has not already happened to you, as when Thanatos comes to you, she inflicts death upon you, in very violent and brutal ways, and kind of is this sort of embodiment of that brutality of the reality of war, which I think is a really interesting juxtaposition between Thanatos as the glorious soldier, and she is Kerr is an embodiment of the reality of the brutality of war.
Makes me think of Eris too, like less connected with death, but still just this woman who is there for the violence of war. Oh, I love that. It's also fascinating, and I'm noticing that it's been over an hour and a half of us talking about this. I mean, I've got no complaints, but I will have us wrap up. But this, oh my God, I could talk to you forever. So thank you for coming on again, Ellie.
You're welcome. I love coming on.
I'm so glad. I love that. For the listeners, this was like a really last minute idea I had where I was like, I just want to talk about the underworld, but can you just come on sometime before Halloween? And you made it work. So thank you. Do you want to tell my listeners where they can find you? And I'm thinking of your lovely TikToks, which I also referenced in an episode this month, and all the other things you want to share.
Well, yes, you can find me on TikTok at Ellie Mac and Roberts. You can find me on Twitter at Ellie M Roberts. My Underworld Gods book has recently been released in paperback. So you can now get that for not a horrifically expensive £120 or whatever it was.
You can also get it in ebook, because I bought it on my iPad and it was also considerably more affordable on that route. So I will also vouch for that one. And it was faster because I needed it quickly.
That's it.
Wonderful. Well, I was thrilled to have your TikTok on this recent episode I did on on like the Chthonic goddesses, because I made your point on when Persephone is and is not in the underworld based on your TikTok. So thank you. Oh, as always, thank you all so much for listening. Man, I love these conversations. I really love talking with Ellie. This episode was so much fun. So full of so many underworld ideas and concepts and characters. And so happy Halloween. Enjoy this final spooky season. And I will see you Wednesday for another bonus Cupid after show. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians and handles so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by Acast. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek myth and the ancient Mediterranean broadly by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click on the link in this episode's description. I am Liv, and I love this shit very much. Like, oracles of the dead? Are you serious?
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Ah, thinking about gas mileage. You know, changing your oil with a full synthetic oil like Castrol Edge can help your engine get more miles. Right now, you can get 5 quarts with an STP Extended Life Oil Filter for only $36.99. Get started on your next job today with the parts you need when you need them at AutoZone or AutoZone.com.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.